I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Sarah. And together, we're the co-founders of Whale Tales, a living library of cetacean stories.
And today, we're going to beguile each other with some fun dolphin facts.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Plus, a dolphin-y whale tale.
So sit back and enjoy as we dive right in.
And happy Dolphin Awareness Month. Whoop whoop. It is March. Spring is springing in the Northern Hemisphere. And dolphins are dancing and diving and doing other de-alliterative word things. And we're aware of it.
Yes. Yes.
We are so aware. So aware, in fact, that we are recreating something that got a lot of positive feedback from you and from ourselves. Because, yes. You know, sometimes we give each other feedback that we did last year for Dolphin Awareness Month, which is we have all shown up to record today with a new to us dolphin fact that we learned, but we have not shared with each other. And we're going to share them right now, and I'm going first. Hooray! So my fun dolphin fact, which is new as of a paper that was published in late 2022, but it also only kind of got non-journal attention in December of 2023, so relatively new, we shall say, is that bottlenose dolphins have an extra sense. Dun, dun, dun. Specifically, it is a sense that sharks have and lots of other marine creatures and land creatures and so on and so forth. Doesn't matter. The point is, drum roll please.
They can see Bruce Willis.
No. I mean, I'm sure Bruce
Willis has. We haven't tested that theory yet, Lindsay.
Now I have to drum roll again, Lindsay.
Couldn't okay. help myself.
This is true. This is very fair. Dolphins can sense electric fields.
Mm. So yeah. Cool.
So specifically, this study has been done on two bottlenose dolphins in the Nuremberg Zoo. Their names are Donna and Dolly. Great. No notes. And the study started with, we will post in the show notes the whole paper. Hooray! Because free science, ooh la la. So you can read the whole paper, and I encourage you to, not only because it's a fascinating paper, but because it's very diagram heavy in terms of explaining how they conducted the study with Donna and Dolly to try and detect and basically train them to recognize electric fields. And then tried to measure the variety and kind of like the strength of the electric field that they could recognize. So there's a lot of diagrams of, you know, like the apparatus they used in the studies and all that kind of stuff. It's really, really cool. But basically, the hypothesis originated when the researchers, who were Tim Hunter and Guido Denhart, were watching a bottlenose dolphin calf, which I think we've talked about on the pod before. Many cetaceans, when they are first born, they have little hair, very similar to whiskers on their beaks or rostrums. And they were looking at these, they've called them whiskers in the paper, they were looking at these whiskers on the dolphin calves, and when those fall out, when the vibrissae fall out, it leaves behind these pits. And they noticed that the pits closely resemble the pits in a shark's nose area, or rostrum area, that are the ampullae of Lorenzini. I haven't said that in so long. I'm so impressed that came back to me. Oh my gosh, it's been almost a decade since I've said that. Yes, the pits in a shark's rostrum are called the ampullae of Lorenzini, and that's how they detect electric fields. And sharks have been known to do this for quite some time, and they're very, very good at it. And so these two researchers were like, huh, I wonder. And turns out, yeah, dolphins can detect electric fields. They're not as good at it as sharks. So, you know, score for one for shark, but that's fine. Because sharks deserve love too. But they are very sensitive. And what's particularly interesting is, so I'm not going to give a whole electric field lecture because A, I don't understand it enough to do that. And B, that's not the podcast you signed up for, listeners. But what I will say is there are two different kinds of electric fields. There are active electric fields and steady electric fields. And what's happening to the electricity in that electric field is as it would suggest. In an active electric field, it's alternating, it's moving, it's an active current that is kind of like fluctuating in its pulse. And in a steady electric field, that's not changing. So real life scenarios, an active electric field is something produced by a living creature. So all living things, especially all living animal things, produce electricity. Your heart beating is bioelectric. And the fact that it beats means that there are fluctuations in the amount of electricity going on. This is turning into an electric field lecture. I'm sorry. An example of a steady electric field would be like the different electric magnetic fields going on in Earth. So what was really interesting is that the dolphins were better at sensing steady electric fields than they were at sensing active or alternating fields. They can sense both, but they were better at sensing steady fields. So the implications that these two researchers have put forth is obviously any amount of ability to sense bioelectricity would help you find animals that are hiding. So especially when bottlenose dolphins use their very pointed rostrums to kind of like dig in the sand, they might not solely be using echolocation, which can find prey under the sand, but they might also be relying on the ability to sense electro something. Huh. I lost my train of thought for a second, but like to sense the electricity of their prey as well as their echolocation. But also because they are better at sensing the steady electric fields, they might be using this to orient themselves to Earth. So there you go.
Interesting.
In summary, two bottlenose dolphins named Dolly and Donna are able to sense electric fields, and it's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yay.
So fun.
Who wants to go next?
I'll go.
Okay.
So mine is older. An older fact, not new like yours. Mm. But it's an important one. It's my, I just kind of had a weird, like a query in my head. And then looking into this is one of those ones where you think about all of that kind of stuff that people might know already and like how important it is and how necessary it is to do all the baseline research on all animals. Again, we talk about this all the time, coming from a place where we live next to the most well-known cetaceans in the history of the world. It's hard to realize at times that other animals don't have that kind of, some of them do, don't, but some of them we know absolutely nothing about. Anyway, that's just a long rambly tale to talk about spotted dolphins, because I was wondering if you could identify them with your dots, with their dots, their spots. The answer seems to be probably not. But they are individual. They are unique to the individual. However, probably not maybe when they're older, because they do change.
Ooh.
So this study is from a paper from 1997 from the Wild Dolphin Project, which has all of its papers online. Hooray! And has been studying Atlantic spotted dolphins in the Bahamas for many, many years. So basically what they did is they went down there. This paper is, also they wanted to look at sexual reproduction and a couple of different other things, as well as sexual identification. Basically a lot of the baseline stuff of how do you identify things in dolphins, and reproductive status and all that kind of stuff. But so what they did was they sat in the beach for 9 years, 1985 to 1994, and looked at dolphins, which sounds pretty dope to me. But basically, because they knew these dolphins so well and they knew a lot of their ages already, they were able to backtrack from that and identify the four different phases of spotted dolphins spotting over the course of their age. So actually, it's technically five, because they are born without spots, and there are some species or subspecies of spotted dolphins that don't actually have dots, but not these ones. So Atlantic spotted dolphins are born without dots. They're just gray, just boring gray dolphins. And then for their first 3 to 4 years, they are two-tone, which is just a one spot or something along those lines, kind of boring. And then from 4 to 9, they are speckled, which is they develop at least two, very exciting, probably, black spots on their ventral side, and then a few light gray ones on their dorsal. And they start usually around 3 to 4, and it increases throughout those time phases. And then into their teen years, 10 to 16, they become mottled. And that's when they develop extensive and merging gray and white spots on the dorsal surface and continue to gain spots on their black, on their backs. After that, as they age, the spots, they enter the fused state, which is the last state. And that's basically when the development of spots accelerates. Fused state is when they dark and white spots become extensive and coalesce on the ventral and dorsal sides. Some old males have pronounced white rostrum tips, similar to reported in other species of spotted dolphin. And this color phase spans up to 10 years. So that's the kind of thing that's interesting. So they do have to identify, the way that they identify them is actually similar to Risso's with like fins and nicks and stuff like that, because their spots change. So probably when they grow, when they reach the age of maturity and their spots maybe slow down, they could be identified by them, but it's not a positive identifying feature, even though it is the identifying feature of the species. So yeah, it's a cool study, and it's one of those ones that, because it's a population of dolphins that come to the same place every year, the researchers are able to access it every year. It's one of those super long-term studies where you can know the individuals that you're studying, watch them grow, know their exact age, know their sex, and so then therefore you can learn so many things from them. And so this one, along with all the other ones, they've been studying these dolphins since the 80s. They've been able to learn so many different things about the species of dolphin from these guys. And yeah, studying dolphins in the Bahamas was literally what I thought I was going to do when I grew up, but now I'm here instead.
Amazing. That's so cool, Lince. So it's very funny because my study is also about, or my fact is also about bottlenose dolphins and also in the Bahamas. But unrelated to either of those things. So I found a very interesting paper because I was like, oh, last time we talked about foraging, I wonder if there's like more foraging stuff. So I was like, foraging, dolphins, something. I can't remember what I Googled. And this was like the third thing that came up based on my Google search. So it's a paper called Behavioral Laterality in Foraging Bottlenose Dolphins. And I was like, oh, I mean, I'm not that interested in bottlenose dolphins. Like, they're fine, but it wasn't what I was aiming for. But basically, in the top level thing was, turns out, so lateralized behavior is what we call handedness. So like being right-handed or left-handed. And I'm sure we've talked about this before. In particular, like gray whales are known to mm-hmm. turn to the right. Turns out lots of animals exhibit handedness. And this population of bottlenose dolphins, Triceps truncatus, in these shallow sandy waters off the Bahamas, in somewhere called Bimini, do a foraging behavior called crater feeding, where they swim along the ocean floor where they're scanning using echolocation, and then they'll do a sudden turn and bury their rostrum into the substrate to get the food. And there's basically, so based on data that they collected from 2012 to 2018, I should say this is a paper in the Royal Society Open Science Journal, and it's by Daisy Kaplan and some other authors. And so, yeah, so based on data that they collected from 2012 to 2018, they reported a significant right side, so doing a left turn in these dolphins. So they turn left and then their right side goes down towards the surface of the water, down towards the sand.
Yeah.
And by significant, 709 turns were recorded. 99.4 of them with their right side down. Only four were the other way, and they were all in one individual.
Oh, Sinestra.
Yeah, basically. So they then go on to hypothesize about why this right side bias
And it might actually have to do with echolocation production, because they referenced another study. I mean, they referenced all kinds of studies about other lateralization in other species, but in particular, another study where they looked at the phonic lips that are used to produce echolocation, because I think we also have talked about this before. The phonic lips, they have two pairs, and this study proved, or like pretty conclusively proved, that when they echolocate, so they do the clicks with the right side phonic lips and the whistles and other vocals with the left side. So this is a paper from 2013. Before that, everybody had assumed that in order to do the complexity of clicks, they would need to be using both. But this study basically was like, yeah, no, they only need one side. So all their echolocation is done with their right side phonic lips. And tersiops have a strong right eye preference as well. They're like, if in studies where they've covered one eye or the other, they have better visual acuity with their right eye. So all of these things, so like as they're echolocating, they like turn down to like put their right eye down towards where they're echolocating to be able to find the food, which I thought was fascinating. And also there's some really great pictures in the initial study of the overhead views of these and like sort of how the turn works. Cause I was confused about like they turn left and then their right side's down. But once you see pictures, it makes sense. Yeah. So also this paper just has some really fascinating examples of lateralization across all kinds of species. There's a lot of right-sided lateralization, but some on both sides. So, and I just found it was interesting that both eye and echolocation are both on the right side, so that means they're using the left side of their brain for all of their visualizing of information, whether that's like visual or sound-based information. Then they use it to somehow visualize. I mean, visualize is the wrong word, it's a very anthropomorphic term for it, but build a mental model of an object's shape is all in the left hemisphere of their brain. So I was completely fascinated and blown away that they were both that they were able to figure it out in the concept of the phonic lips thing. Like that study, I don't really understand how they did it, but it's very fascinating to read about. And then, this other study that's able to sort of elaborate on that and hypothesize various reasons why this like right side down towards the where the food is bias. Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot to say that I couldn't find any good photos of the color, the different phases of spotting. There are photos in the paper, but it is a scan of a paper of which is has photos in it that are scanned. This is 1997. And they're in black and white also. So I'll keep looking for social media, but if you are interested, you could check out the paper. But yeah, they're not great. Anyway, yours are probably better because it's 2018. It's newer.
And yeah. And also they're not trying to show spots. They're just like...
Yeah.
Dolphin.
Look at this dolphin
underwater. Yeah. Yeah.
Look at it turn. Mm-hmm. How did none of us make a Zoolander joke?
I don't know. I was so distracted.
I don't know.
But that one poor dolphin who gets bullied at school because he's
probably
left.
Well, those were some dolphiny dolphin facts, people. Thank you for sharing.
Hooray.
I learned so much.
Before we continue with the rest of the episode, we want to take a moment to tell you about how you can support our podcast and everything we do at Whale Tales.
You can join us by becoming a patron at patreon.com/whaletales. For $1 a month, you can join at the porpoise level, $5 a month, the dolphin level, or $10 a month at the whale level.
And each level comes with a variety of perks, including polls, thank you postcards, access to extended interviews or extra stories with guests. We just put up an extra story. It's awesome. You can produce your own fun flipper fact segment of the pod. And we have two Patreon exclusive extra podcasts because we just can't get enough about talking about cetaceans. On alternating months, we have our Journal Club episodes. So our most recent one is coming out this month, or did just come out. It did come out. Yep. Thank you. Timing doesn't work in my brain. And we talk about dolphin sex because, you know, we don't talk about that enough. So if that's up your alley, join us for Journal Club as a dolphin or whale level patron. And then on alternating months, we have for our whale level patrons our super fun podcast, Whale Tales Watches, where we watch a thing or read a thing that is marine biologically adjacent I just keep making up words to describe this podcast. And then we talk about what they got right and what they got wrong, and it devolves, and it's always a great time.
Always joyful.
Our last episode of that for our patrons was an amazing movie. I can't stop talking about how much I love this movie. It's Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, aka the one with the whales.
Yeah.
And next month, we will be watching Atlantis, the Disney movie, which none of us have watched for a very long time. So join us to hear about, you know, Disney's accuracy level as it continues.
We already know. Yeah. It's great. Thank you so much to all of our patrons. You are so amazing.
Agreed. Great. But don't worry, if you aren't able to support us financially but want to help out, there's still lots of things you can do. You can always leave us a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice, which will help other people find us. And you'd also just tell your cetacean science podcast loving friends about the podcast and everything we do at Whale Tales so that they can join in too.
Yay! Plus, you can follow us on social media at whaletales_org, where you can send us your feedback so that we can keep making the podcast even better. We love hearing from you. Agreed. So please, please just say hi.
Yeah.
And hi, I love whales. It'll make our day. It really will. All right. So everybody know what time it is?
Oh, yay! I do.
Yeah, you do.
Mm-hmm. So excited.
What time is it? It's fun flipper fact time. What time is it? It's fun flipper fact time. Dolphin edition. Yeah.
Amazing.
Today's fun flipper fact actually comes to us from the aforementioned Patreon peoples. Patreon patrons?
Sure.
Patreons?
From our lovely patrons over at Patreon. How many times can I say that?
I don't know. Let's keep trying. Yeah.
And this was a Patreon fun flipper fact poll where we polled our patrons. Oh my gosh, the amount of P words coming out of my mouth. And we asked them, which dolphin would you like to learn a fun flipper fact about in this month's episode? And the results are in. And the dolphin that our patrons most wanted to learn about was the humpback dolphin.
Hooray!
But which one?
Oh.
You might ask. Ahaha. So, we're getting back on another one of our very well-trodden soapboxes.
Oh, more taxonomy talk.
Yep. Because there are not one, not two, not three, but four recognized species of humpback dolphins. Yep.
Goodness gracious.
That's right. Four recognized species of humpback dolphins.
It's not that there's more of those than there are of orca species. Anyway.
No, not at all. Not at all. There is the Indo-Pacific humpback dolphin, which lives in the Indo-Pacific. the Indian Ocean humpback dolphin, which lives in the
Indian
Ocean. The Atlantic humpback dolphin.
They really strain themselves on these ones, huh?
Which lives in the Atlantic. I'll get into the specifics of where, because it is not like the whole Atlantic. And finally, the Australian humpback dolphin, which lives in Australia. You really thought I was going to say. Yeah. No, they don't go to New Zealand at all. It's very Australia.
But isn't the Indo-Pacific around Australia, she asks?
Yes, yes. Good point. So I will differentiate. The Indo-Pacific humpback dolphin. So, okay, actually very specifically for all of these four different species. I'll stop being sarcastic. They live in very, very coastal waters. So these are not deep diving animals at all. If you look at a map of their distribution, it's like you're back in whatever grade where you had to trace countries.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they're very, 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 very close to shore. So because you asked the question, Linz, with absolutely no sarcasm in your voice either, the Indo-Pacific humpback dolphin is in the coastal waters of specifically Bangladesh, Brunei, and Cambodia.
Okay.
As well as parts of India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Myanmar or Burma, the People's Republic of China, the Philippines, Singapore, Taiwan, Thailand, and Vietnam.
We're all over the dang place.
Yeah.
Yes. Whereas the Australia, so you notice I did not say Australia, no. Even though, yes, the Indo-Pacific Ocean touches Australia. But the Australian humpback dolphin is only found in the coastal waters of Australia and Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So, I mean, I get why they named the Indo-Pacific dolphin the Indo-Pacific. Like, yes, they're kind of all over the place. And then I guess saying the Australian and Papua New Guinea humpback dolphin was just a step too far. Yes. Then the Indian Ocean humpback dolphin is in Bangladesh, as well as the Indo-Pacific dolphin. So they do have a little bit of overlap there. Comoros, Egypt, also parts of India. So again, some overlap with the Indo-Pacific. Iran, Iraq, Israel, Kenya, Kuwait, Madagascar, Mozambique, Myanmar, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, South Africa, Sri Lanka, Sudan, Tanzania, and Yemen, as well as a couple of other places. But not too much overlap. And again, in just very, very small coastal parts of these countries. And finally, the Atlantic humpback dolphin can be found in Angola, Benin?
I think Benin.
Wow, why are there so many different ways to say that word? The Congo, both the Republic of Congo and the Democratic Republic of Congo, because mm-hmm. those are two different things. Equatorial Guinea, the Gambia, Ghana, Guinea-Bissau, Liberia, Nigeria, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Togo, and the Western Sahara.
Right. Mm. So like around the hook, like the curvy part of Africa, the north.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of this is to say, I'm getting back on my soapbox, everybody.
Shocking.
You've got four distinct, like, geographically distinct, but like
overlapping in
the same chunk of the map and overlapping distributions of a dolphin that looks very similar. That was going to be
my next question.
Nope, they look basically the same, except sometimes they're pink. I'll come back to that. That's the most interesting thing about them. And yet, at their global population, when you add all four species together, is smaller than the global population of orcas, but we can't get our act together and decide that any of the ecotypes, not even just all of them, but any of them, classify as a distinct different species.
One of these days,
I'm
man.
Never not going to be frustrated about that. Anyway, all this to say is, this doesn't mean I don't like humpback dolphins. They're great.
They didn't do anything wrong.
They didn't.
They don't all care what species they are.
All of my animosity and sarcasm comes to the naming people who, I mean, listeners know this, we're always mad at the naming people.
But not like the individuals, the system.
Yeah, the system. But humpback dolphins are great. They are typically pretty shy, less active than some of the deeper diving, more pelagic dolphin species that you can find in the area. So they're not usually a species that you will see a lot of, but if you're close to shore, they are also close to shore, and they get their name from the distinct, let's call it a hump, because that's what they're all calling it, the humpback dolphin. So this distinct hump on their back, and then the dorsal fin, because they do have a dorsal fin as well, comes out of mm-hmm. their hump. Mm. So it's kind of like this nice smooth back, and then a
yeah.
If you're tracing,
it looks like it. Yeah. If you sort of like cover up the dolphin part and just had the dorsal fin, it would be like how a like 7-year old would draw a mountain.
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not a little kid mountain, like a medium kid mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 And as mentioned, sometimes they're pink. Yeah. So most of the time they're gray, but sometimes they're pink. And that's very cool.
Yeah. That is very cool. Yeah.
It is very cool. It's very pretty to see in pictures. So what causes the pink coloration? Because it's not based on age or what they eat or any of that. It's just a genetic, you know, like some people have red hair and some people have black hair. So adult humpback dolphins can be gray, which is the more predominant genetic trait. They are often gray, and then sometimes they can be white and sometimes they can be pink, and it is not their skin pigment that is pink. The pink color originates from their blood vessels, so beneath the skin obviously, which overdevelop for thermoregulation, so it just allows the blood to show through their skin, and then they look pink, and it's very, very pretty. They're very pretty dolphins, and they come in all kinds of like varieties of mottled as well. So there's like some gray dabbling.
Ooh, ooh la la.
Or dappling, if we're going with horse related terminology out now, of nowhere.
Nicole, say I was in India, which yes. And I see a humpback dolphin. How do I know which one it is?
I can't help you with that. Which comes down to, again, my significant issues with the people who are the system who are naming these things. My best bet is that it would depend on what part of India you're in, and if I knew a lot more about them, then perhaps their distribution doesn't actually overlap, because like distinct parts of India, because obviously
India's a big country.
India is very big and has multiple coastlines, so maybe that, but I don't know that 100%, so I'm not going to give a 100% accurate answer.
Amazing. Very fair.
Well, yes. Thanks, patrons, for voting in a fun way.
Hooray! Yes. We learned so much today.
Yeah. Yay! And we got to rant all of my favorite things.
Okay, so now we have a whale tale and a call to action from Lauren. Lauren, would you like to introduce yourself before we go further?
Yes, so hi, I'm Lauren. I'm a scientific illustrator. I focus on cetaceans, so whales, dolphins, and porpoises. I've worked with species such as common bottlenose dolphins and Amazon river dolphins, and I am now working as an environmental educator. So very excited to be here today.
Yeah, that's so cool. Awesome. Do you want to start with a dolphin story?
Yeah. So definitely I will always think back of studying abroad in Brazil. It's one of my favorite experiences I've ever had, and definitely with Amazon river dolphins. I started to notice during the trip that I wasn't seeing them very often. It was pretty difficult to spot them when the boat was moving. And we were living on a riverboat for about a week. And I started to realize that I would stay behind sometimes. So like the other people in our group would leave. And I asked my professor if I could just stay behind, because I wanted to see if maybe I could spot them just from the boat while it was parked and quiet. And I had some of the most amazing encounters observing them. Mm. It was crazy. Once the boat would just stop and it would be quiet, it's like they would magically appear. And they would start socializing around the boat. My professor told me, like, you probably won't see them leaping. I've never seen them leap. And lo and behold, when I was on the boat, started seeing them leap multiple times. Only got it once on my camera. I wish I could have. It was hard to time those leaps, because they were very sudden. Mm-hmm. But that was definitely one of my favorite encounters, and it just kind of taught me to be patient and understand our impact on those animals, because those boats can be very loud, and once it was stopped and parked, they just were having a great time. They were feeding by our boat and socializing. So it was very special getting to witness that, and just seeing how being quiet and patient, like the rewards of respecting wildlife. So
yeah. Oh, that's amazing. That's just so far up the bucket list. I can't even deal with it. Oh, incredible. Great.
They're amazing.
So what kind of research were you guys working on with the river dolphins?
So I asked my professor to do an independent study. So there used to be a professor at the university that I went to who actually did research on Amazon river dolphins. Mm. He was a psychology professor. Mm-hmm. Sadly, we also used to have a American Cetacean Society student chapter at that university. So he used to be very involved, but once he left the university, it's been very quiet with the dolphins. And I just wanted to, focus on a project that was more about outreach and merging scientific illustration. So I definitely asked her, I was like, can I just, you know, I have my camera. I would love to take some really good photos and make kind of a field guide, something that she could use for future students who are going on this trip and maybe even encourage more independent studies and research on these animals. So one of the project that I did was, of course, outreach. I made a big poster, talked about all the different behaviors. I focused mostly on what we saw on the trip. They can, of course, show a lot of other different behaviors, but I focused specifically on what I saw, included some other things, some of the threats to the species, but it was just a big poster, and I'm hoping that she will use it in the future for students. I'm sure she has. I will be presenting it in April again. Cool. To the university. So it's definitely been helping people learn more about those animals. As an environmental educator, I'm very passionate about sharing those animals. So
yeah. Oh, yeah. That's really cool. So speaking of which, we also wanted to get a call to action from you. You posted a little while ago on Twitter about some of the work you're doing with the Stranding Network and some things that people can do and kind of help out all cetaceans. But, you know, we're very dolphin themed this month, of course. So, yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the work you've been doing for them.
Awesome. So I recently became a volunteer for them. This was in 2023. They actually hadn't opened up volunteer opportunities since COVID, so 2020. So once I saw that, like 3 years later, I put in the application like 3 years ago, and they were finally opening them back up. So we do a lot there. This can include necropsies. It can be necropsies in the lab, on the beach. We also respond to live strandings. Of course, that takes a lot more training and time volunteering for them. We also haven't, I think we only had, we had a mom and calf that were in a place they weren't supposed to be. And a lot of the more experienced volunteers helped with that one. So we do necropsies, do rescues. Of course, we do outreach. And then we also do rehab. We haven't had a rehab patient in a while. One that probably a lot of people know of is Izzy. Izzy now lives at the Clearwater Marine Aquarium. She was a dolphin that people were interacting with in the wild. And then she eventually had to be rehabbed, and now she's taken care of in Florida.
Great.
So volunteering for them has been awesome. I know that the first experience I had with them was a necropsy. Ooh. I was very nervous for it because necropsies can be smelly. And I remember I got the email that night, and of course they can never tell when a dolphin is going to strand. They, you know, it all happens on random. So you'll get a random email saying, oh, we need volunteers to help us now or tomorrow. So I got an email that was talking about the 8-foot male bottlenose dolphin that was found in one of our ship channels. Yeah, he was big. He was actually found by one of the other research institutes that I worked with as an undergrad. So they pulled him in from the ship channel, and they wanted to do necropsy on him, and they were looking for volunteers. So that night, I ran to CVS, and I grabbed some Vicks, because Vicks helps with the smell. And I was very nervous about it, because I've heard about people passing out during necropsies. Because it's just, you're in there for a long time. But I got to help out with that, and it was so cool. And the smell didn't bother me that much, which is awesome.
Were you inside also, or outside?
So we were inside.
Okay, that definitely helps. The only necropsy I've been to was outside in the summer, and that was a lot. Anyway, continue.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. But it was like, especially as a scientific illustrator, I've never seen a dolphin that close up.
Yeah.
I normally see them from shore, or I've been on a boat-based survey and I saw them. We can get closer on the boat-based surveys because we have a permit. But seeing one that close and seeing all the markings, and of course I was working on a project before that necropsy where I needed to do a full body illustration of one of the common bottlenose dolphins. And I had already finished that project. And I was like, oh, of course I see, like, you know, super up close, like perfect view of a dolphin after I'd already submitted that project. But it was incredible. Seeing the different organs too. I believe that we didn't find a cause of death on that one. I think it was just old age. But he was very big. He was very cool. I can't relate enough how cool it was. I've been hoping they haven't done another, from my knowledge, they haven't done any more in the lab in a while. They must be doing them outside because January through March is our stranding season.
Okay.
So they've just been coming in. And now that I'm employed full time, it's hard to get back out there because it'll just happen on a Monday morning. It's like, I'm at work. But hope for the weekends or days that I have off. So
great. So aside from volunteering, which can obviously there's wait lists and stuff at times and training, and depending on where people are, what can other people do you think that can help all of dolphins or cetaceans in their everyday life?
Awesome. So I definitely think that if you live in an area where you can see them from shore, or maybe you have a reputable whale watching company, definitely go with reputable companies. Also, try to view them from shore if you can. That's a great way to minimize your impact. You can watch them as long as you can if they're close to shore. I know that where we are, we don't have any. I know that most of these programs are voluntary, but we don't have any dolphin tours that have any of these, like, you know, oh, we have this certification to do this. So that's why I prefer to watch from shore, because I know that I'm not having much of an impact. Also, if you're ever out there, if you see any monofilament, pick it up. If there's a monofilament like a little trash disposal for monofilament specifically, great to use those. And then maybe even talk to people around you. And I know I've had a lot of really cool conversations with fishers. Asking them about, how often do you see dolphins out here? What are your interactions with dolphins normally? And sometimes they'll tell me they think they're cool. Sometimes they tell me that they don't like them. definitely cleaning up monofilament, watching them responsibly. Keeping the area as it was when you visited. So if you go to the beach, of course, pick up all of your stuff. And of course, volunteer. Volunteer if you can. There's so many cool opportunities. We only see one species here in Texas off the coast. But I know there's other places you can see all different kinds of species, and getting involved, you'll have so many cool opportunities. And even just reaching out with a simple email to someone, being like, hey, how can I get involved? Like, networking and just making connections is so important, especially if you really want to get involved to the point of, like, getting into research or rehabilitation for cetaceans, all of that. So
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Lauren. Would you mind sharing with us your social media handles or website or anything you want to send people to get to know you or the places that you work with?
So you can mostly find me on Instagram. That's where I post almost all the time. So my Instagram handle is Lauren, LAURYNF_illustration. That's where I post my scientific illustrations, my wildlife photography, the dolphin photos that I take from shore. And then, of course, I'm on Twitter. I believe it is the same handle. It's LaurynF_illustration. So those are the best ways to find me and kind of find out what I'm up to. You can also check out the Texas Marine Mammal Stranding Network. You just type them in on Google. They've been doing a lot of really cool posts for Dolphin Awareness Month. There's been a lot of, especially as volunteers, we've had a lot of really cool opportunities to get involved this month with outreach, especially talking to people about dolphins, getting out there. And then you can also check out the Galveston Bay Dolphin Research Program. I was a research student intern with them. They are awesome. I know the researchers. We meet up sometimes. It's really cool to be working with them with some of my projects. So it's a great way to especially learn about some of the dolphins that we have here in Texas, yeah. Especially in Galveston. So.
Cool. That's super cool. Thank you so much, Lauren, for coming and
of course.
Talking to us about dolphins.
Thank you so much for having me.
Woo. Yay! Aw, thank you so much for that story. That was lovely. Woo. Well, I think that brings us to the end, folks. We did it.
Good job, and team.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on the thing that we just did. Or any of the episodes that we've ever recorded, ever, ever, ever. So please visit our website, whale-tales.org, and find links to our social media handles so that you can drop us a line.
You can also head to our website to subscribe to the podcast, learn about supporting us and becoming a patron, and read over 1,300 whale, dolphin, and porpoise stories.
Wow.
I know.
That's whale-tales.org. Tales like the stories, not tales like the animal.
And if you've seen a cetacean, we would love to add your story to our library. You can click the share link on our website, or you can contact us on social media at whaletales_org, or you can email us a voice memo and tell us all about your incredible cetacean encounter.
Finally, we want to acknowledge that we recorded today's episode on the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples and the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, as well as the homelands of the Tsawwassen First Nation.
Thank you, everybody, and we hope you have a dolphin-y Whaley, great day.